Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for inviting me to speak here this morning. It would clearly test to destruction the tolerance of the ordinary red-blooded Australian to have a POM getting off the train from London and telling them how to run their country. So I shall not presume to say how the current human rights debate in this country should be resolved. But perhaps I may contribute some thoughts, prompted by our own experience in the United Kingdom, acknowledging, as I do so, that the Australian context, while in some ways similar, is in others significantly different. In the autumn of 1992, as has already been said, I was appointed Master of the Rolls, in effect the President of the Civil Division of the Court of Appeal of England and Wales. I was interviewed by a radio journalist who asked what single change I would most like to see made in the law. I said my choice would be to give domestic effect to the European Convention on Human Rights, to which the United Kingdom had formally acceded in 1951, the first state to do so. This was not in any way a novel or original choice on my part. The former head of my chambers in the Temple in London, Lord Scarman, had strongly argued for incorporation of the convention in some lectures which he gave in 1975, and even more particularly after his retirement from the House of Lords in 1986. Two bills providing for incorporation had passed through the House of Lords, only to fail in the House of Commons. In recent years, incorporation had been championed by a number of prominent advocates, among them Lord Leicester of Herne Hill QC. But in 1992, both the main parties, for rather different reasons, were adamantly opposed to the idea of giving domestic effect to the convention, which was supported only by the numerically weak Liberal Democrats. On the 2nd of March of the next year, 1993, I developed my reasons for favouring incorporation in a Denning lecture entitled The European Convention on Human Rights, Time to Incorporate. By then, however, the political scene had altered significantly. Just before my lecture, the late John Smith, the leader of the Labour Party in opposition, encouraged, as I understand, by a shadow Lord Chancellor, Lord Irvine, had adopted incorporation of the convention as part of the Labour Party's programme. This, despite misgivings in some sections of the party, it thereafter remained. It's very well known that the European Convention, like the Universal Declaration which it followed, found its genesis in the horrors which had afflicted much of the world in the 1930s and 1940s. At the end of World War II, the victorious European allies, Britain and France, were prominent in promoting and drafting the convention, wanting to share with other less fortunate nations the rights and freedoms which they themselves took for granted. After all, we in Britain had grown up on Magna Carta, and the French on the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen of 1789. I don't think either country foresaw that its own laws and institutions would be subjected to scrutiny and found wanting. By the 1990s, however, there was no longer room for complacency in Britain, that we had nothing to learn. As early as the 1950s, complaints made by Greece about British conduct in Cyprus had caused official embarrassment, to put it no higher. One suspect had been subjected to what was then called the Chinese water torture, now better known as waterboarding. A 15-year-old Cypriot suspect had been whipped so severely as to leave him in pain for several days and required treatment in hospital. After the rather casual grant by the British government of a right of individual petition to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg in 1966, the rate of applications to Strasbourg sharply increased, and so did the incidence of decisions adverse to the United Kingdom. Thus, violations were found in relation to the right to life, the right not to be subjected to inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment, the right to personal liberty, the right to a fair trial, the right to respect for private life, the right to freedom of expression, the right to freedom of association, and the right not to be discriminated against in the enjoyment of convention rights. Throughout this period, the orthodox rule in Britain was that the convention, as an unincorporated treaty, was not part of English law, and therefore no notice could be taken of it by the British courts, save interstitially, as for instance where a statutory provision was found to be capable of bearing two meanings, one consistent and one inconsistent with the international obligations of the United Kingdom as expressed in the convention, in which event preference was to be given to the consistent meaning. The context, of course, was throughout the period that the United Kingdom was bound in international law as a party to the convention to abide by it and comply with Strasbourg decisions to which it was party. And it was widely regarded, perhaps even universally regarded, as unthinkable to renounce the convention. It seemed to me in the early 1990s, and it still does, that this orthodox approach had at least four grave weaknesses. First, it meant that complaints reached the European institutions at Strasbourg without the benefit of any domestic judgment addressing the convention issues. Sometimes such a judgment would have made no difference. Quite often it would. Of course, litigants were required to exhaust their domestic remedies before going to Strasbourg, but this was a rather sterile process when there were no domestic remedies to exhaust. It was always my expectation that the United Kingdom's record would improve when the court in Strasbourg had the benefit of a British judgment, and so, in fact, it has proved. Secondly, it seems to me highly important that any domestic legal system should command the confidence of the public as one which is inclusive, belongs to them, and affords a remedy for obvious wrongs. It's destructive of such confidence if there's a justified belief that for a significant category of serious wrongs, the domestic court can offer no remedy, and the disappointed litigant is obliged to go away and seek this superior form of justice abroad. Such, until the Human Rights Act came into force, was the position. Thirdly, it was very undesirable that members of the public should be put to the expense and the very considerable delay of seeking redress in Strasbourg for a convention complaint which could, had the convention been part of domestic law, have been granted much more inexpensively and a great deal more quickly at home. The fourth weakness was the most serious of all. If the rights and freedoms embodied in the convention were, as described, fundamental, it was a grave defect that they were not fully protected in domestic law. Of course, many of them were protected by the common law and statute and a mixture of the two, and the judges, on the whole, did their best to remedy perceived injustices. But the coverage was piecemeal, as evident from the record of cases lost by the United Kingdom at Strasbourg, and it's not easy to see why fundamental rights and freedoms should not be directly and expressly recognised in domestic law without taxing the ingenuity of the judges. Perhaps I may give just one example to illustrate these weaknesses. In a case reported in the English reports as X brackets minors against Bedfordshire County Council, five child plaintiffs complained in the English court that they'd been the victims of maltreatment and neglect, which had been brought to the attention of the defendant council, but on which for a long time the council had failed to act. The facts were only assumed at the English stage, since it was a strikeout application. But they were accepted or established when the claimants took their complaints to Luxembourg, and the facts were very strong indeed. An experienced and highly respected child psychiatrist described the children's experience as, in her words, to put it bluntly, horrific, and added that it was the worst case of neglect and emotional abuse that she'd seen in the whole of her professional career. The local authorities' failure to intervene, which had permitted the abuse and neglect to continue, was held by a majority of the Court of Appeal and unanimously in the House of Lords to afford the children no tortious remedy in negligence against the local authority in English law, since it was held that the local authority owed the children no duty of care. So the children applied to Strasbourg under the Convention. It was there accepted that the neglect and abuse suffered by the children reached the threshold of inhuman and degrading treatment, and a violation of Article 3 of the European Convention was found, arising from the failure of the system to protect the children from serious long-term neglect and abuse. The court awarded compensation amounting to £320,000, a very large figure by Strasbourg standards, because their awards of compensation are usually rather meagre. The next case to reach the British courts led to acceptance that a local authority in such a situation did owe a duty of care to the children. So, the Labour government of 1997, fresh to office after a long period of Conservative government, inspired by Lord Irvine, the Lord Chancellor, introduced what became the 1998 Act. The general thrust of that Act will, I feel sure, will be very familiar to this audience, but perhaps I may comment on five features of it. First, the cornerstone of the Act is the provision in Section 6.1, which makes it unlawful for any public authority, widely defined so as to include a court or tribunal, to act in a way which is incompatible with a convention right. Thus, Parliament was requiring compliance with the scheduled convention rights across the whole spectrum of government, Parliament itself alone excluded. There's a distinction between the Victorian Act, which, as I understand, does not include the courts or any tribunal as a public authority. The second feature I would mention is the power conferred on the higher courts by Section 4 of the Human Rights Act, if satisfied that a provision of primary legislation is incompatible with a convention right, to make a declaration of incompatibility. This was not to affect the validity of the statute and was not to be binding on the parties, but it would be a formal statement of the court's opinion. If a declaration was made, ministers were empowered but not obliged to put it right. Thus, there was to be no power to annul, strike down, or set aside primary legislation. The reason for this unusual device was very clearly explained in a white paper introducing the bill, from which I quote: "The government," it said, "has reached the conclusion that the court should not have the power to set aside primary legislation, past or future, on the ground of incompatibility with the convention. This conclusion arises from the importance which the government attaches to parliamentary sovereignty. In this context, parliamentary sovereignty means that Parliament is competent to make any law on any matter of its choosing, and no court may question the validity of any act that it passes. In enacting legislation, Parliament is making decisions about important matters of public policy. The authority to make those decisions derives from a democratic mandate. Members of Parliament in the House of Commons possess such a mandate because they're elected, accountable, and representative. To make provision in the bill for the courts to set aside acts of Parliament would confer on the judiciary a general power over the decisions of Parliament, which under our present constitutional arrangements they do not possess, and would be likely on occasions to draw the judiciary into serious conflict with Parliament. There is no evidence to suggest that they desire this power, nor that the public wish them to have it. Certainly this government has no mandate for any such change." That's the end of the quotation. Those closing sentences were, I think, completely accurate. There was no judicial pressure for more sweeping powers, and had the bill not preserved the sovereignty of Parliament, it's perhaps unlikely that it would ever have been passed. The government's expectation at the time was that there would be relatively few declarations of incompatibility, and this has proved to be the case. The government's expectation that there would be very few declarations of incompatibility was attributable to the third feature of the Act, to which I draw attention. This was the requirement in section 3.1 of the Act that, quote, so far as it is possible to do so, primary legislation and subordinate legislation must be read and given effect in a way which is compatible with convention rights. I emphasise the imperative must. This provision also was explained by the White Paper, from which, again, I quote, the Bill provides for legislation, both Acts of Parliament and secondary legislation, to be interpreted so far as possible, so as to be compatible with the Convention. This goes far beyond the present rule, which enables the courts to take the Convention into account in resolving any ambiguity in the legislative provision. The courts will be required to interpret legislation so as to uphold the Convention rights unless the legislation itself is so clearly incompatible with the Convention that it is impossible for it to do so. This, quotes, rule of construction, unquotes, is to apply as well to past as well as to future legislation. To the extent that it affects the meaning of a legislative provision, the courts will not be bound by previous interpretations. They will be able to build a new body of case law taking into account the convention rights. Thus, the intention and the expectation was that use of this unusual interpretative power would obviate the need for a declaration of incompatibility in all but a small minority of cases. The fourth feature I would mention, less well known than the others I've mentioned, is the obligation placed by Section 19 of the Act on a minister in charge of a bill in either House of Parliament before its second reading, either to make a statement that in his view the provisions of the bill are compatible with the convention rights, or to make a statement to the effect that although he is unable to make a statement of compatibility, the government nonetheless wishes the House to proceed with the bill. This second course was followed in relation to what became the Communications Act 2003 because of doubt about the effect of one recent Strasbourg authority. But that was a rarity, and the first course, a statement of belief of compliance, is the norm. Thus, a government bill is ordinarily presented to Parliament on the premise that it is, in the jargon, convention compliant, reflecting the intention of the Human Rights Act as a whole, that the scheduled rights should be reflected, as I've said, across the whole spectrum of public administration. The fifth feature, which is well known, is a requirement the British courts, when determining questions which have arisen in connection with convention rights, must take into account any judgment, declaration, or advisory opinion of the European Court or the European institutions. This has been understood, in my view, correctly, as meaning that Strasbourg authority is not strictly binding on UK courts, like the law of the European Community, which is, but that UK courts should ordinarily follow the Strasbourg jurisprudence unless there's some good reason for not doing so. The United Kingdom, like Australia, is party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, 1966, most of the articles of which, although differently numbered, match corresponding provisions of the European Convention. But I think it's true to say that in the United Kingdom, the impact of the ICCPR and the rulings of the Human Rights Committee of the United Nations have been very marginal compared with those of the Strasbourg institutions. It's no doubt unwelcome, perhaps even a little humiliating, for a proud sovereign state to be found by any respected international body to have violated important human rights, but it must be very doubtful whether the UK's experience of reverses in the Human Rights Committee would have impelled it to give domestic effect to the rights in the ICCPR. To that extent, at least, as it seems to me, the situation in Australia differs from that in the United Kingdom. As is well known, I think, the Human Rights Act 1998 has attracted much media criticism in the UK, particularly in the tabloid and right-wing press and in sections of the Conservative Party. Much of this criticism has been the product of misrepresentation and misunderstanding, and there is a tendency to blame the Act for almost anything of which the public disapprove. But among many ill-directed criticisms are some points which are serious and call for consideration. Whether these are points which have relevance in an Australian context, I must leave you to judge. First, it's sometimes argued that the Act is unnecessary, that common law and statute could readily be interpreted and applied to provide the protection that's needed. Up to a point, this is true. There are well-known cases in which, although the convention is invoked, the courts find the common law and the convention jurisprudence to be in harmony and choose to base their decision on the common law alone. But the common law and statute have not always provided adequate protection, as evidenced by the British record of failure at Strasbourg before 2000 when the Act came into force. As was explained in the white paper already referred to, one of the reasons for this record of failure was that, and I quote, there has simply been no framework within which the compatibility with the convention rights of an executive act or decision can be tested in the British courts. These courts can, of course, review the exercise of executive discretion, but they can do so only on the basis of what is lawful or unlawful according to the law of the United Kingdom as it stands. Thus, the Act was necessary if, in accordance with the UK's duty in international law under Article 1 of the Convention, the rights embodied in the Convention were to be secured to everyone within the jurisdiction of the UK in the domestic courts without the need for a journey to Strasbourg. It said, secondly, that the effect of the Act is to undermine the sovereignty of Parliament. I don't find this point entirely easy to understand. As I've tried to show, the Act was very carefully devised so as to preserve parliamentary sovereignty. It was a surprise to many when, in the course of email exchanges with Henry Porter, an Observer journalist, Tony Blair himself appeared to misunderstand this fundamental premise of the Act. But there is, I suggest, no room at all for doubt. The courts cannot annul an Act of Parliament. They can declare it to be incompatible with a convention right, but that does not affect its validity or effect. Ministers may act to rectify a provision declared to be incompatible, but are not obliged to do so, and may, if they choose, leave the complainant to try his luck in Strasbourg. And it cannot, I think, be suggested, nor to my knowledge has it been suggested, the Parliament lacks the power to repeal the Act if the necessary majority favours that course. There are some statutes, like that giving equal voting rights to women, which Parliament is exceedingly unlikely to repeal, and the 1998 Act may become, or may even be, one of them. But repeal would not free the United Kingdom of its international law duty to comply with the Convention. It's clear, I think, that domestically Parliament has retained the whip hand as was always intended. A third criticism is that the process established by the Act is undemocratic since it permits decisions of the nation's representatives in Parliament, including particularly elected members of the House of Commons, to be challenged by unelected judges. It is, of course, true that a declaration of incompatibility questions the lawfulness of primary legislation and exercise of the interpretative power in Section 3 of the Act may involve the interpretation of legislation in a sense which it is acknowledged Parliament did not intend. This has been described as a strong obligation, and such it is. But if one asks what authority these unelected judges have for departing from their usual role of seeking to give the words of a statute the meaning which Parliament intended its words to bear, the answer is clear. They have the authority of a mandatory instruction issued to them by Parliament itself to determine whether it is possible to read and give effect to primary and subordinate legislation in a way which is compatible with convention rights, of course calls for what may be a difficult and controversial exercise of judgment. But judgment is what judges are paid to exercise, even if unelected. It must nonetheless be accepted, I think, that any bill or charter of rights is in one sense undemocratic, in that it is counter-majoritarian. Its purpose is to give a measure of protection to minorities who lack the strength and the representation to obtain protection through the political process. Prisoners, mental patients, gypsies, homosexuals, asylum seekers, despised racial or religious minorities, and the like. It was recognition by the American founding fathers that a majority may exert its power to oppress a minority, a phenomenon amply demonstrated in the country's history, which inspired the 1791 amendments to the US Constitution, comprising the US Bill of Rights. And such is the inspiration of later instruments also. Chief Justice of Australia, Sir John Latham, made the point very succinctly in 1943 when he said that in Australia, the popular minorities can generally look after themselves. Protective laws are basically for minorities and especially unpopular minorities. A fourth criticism of the Human Rights Act is that it gives too much power to the judges, in particular to make decisions of a sensitive and personal nature. It's true, I think, that the Act leads to judges making decisions of a rather different kind from those which they usually made before. This was recognised in Parliament when the bill was debated and was an intended consequence. But the judges are still making what are distinctively judicial decisions. They have to establish the facts, which are often crucial. They have a text contained partly in the Act and partly in the Convention rights scheduled to the Act. They have principles of interpretation to apply, some of them deriving from domestic sources, some from Strasbourg and other international sources. They have a body of precedent to work on, some of it from Strasbourg, some domestic, some from other sources, some of it binding, some not. The task which the judges perform is not different in kind from their conventional role, and they have, of course, to give reasons based on the text, the principles of interpretation of the authorities for reaching whatever conclusion they do. They are not metamorphosed into legislators, nor is any decision made by a judge, which is not in the last resort made by a judge under the pre-existing regime at Strasbourg. The question for the United Kingdom was which judge was to make the first decision, a British judge or a judge in Strasbourg. Then it said, a fifth criticism, that the Act is a source of mischief because it involves the judges in political controversy and makes for conflict between the government and the judiciary. It's certainly true that in the United Kingdom the courts have given some decisions which, under the Act, which have been very unpopular with the government. But that is also true of judicial review decisions not given under the Act. There is, as I've suggested, a necessary and proper tension between these two arms of government. Particularly when confronted by serious threats such as terrorism, governments understandably seek to exercise their powers to the very limit of what is lawful. But in doing so, they may cross the line which divides the lawful from the unlawful, and then it's the constitutional role of the courts so to hold. There are countries in the world where all judicial decisions find favours with the powers that be, but they're not countries where one would wish to live. Governments, of course, have no greater appetite for losing cases than any other litigant, perhaps even less. But most would recognise that losing cases on occasion is part of the price to be paid for the rule of law. Sixth criticism, sometimes made in the United Kingdom by those who generally favour a bill or charter of rights, is that the Human Rights Act gives domestic effect to the wrong rights. either because the convention, now nearly 60 years old, is looking rather dated, or because it doesn't give effect to distinctively British rights. Neither of these criticisms is, in my view, at all persuasive. The age of the convention is not very relevant, since the articles are expressed, like Chapter 39 of Magna Carta 1215, in very broad terms, and the Strasbourg Court has treated the convention as a living instrument. The meaning of the articles doesn't change, but their application has been held to do so, in relation, for example, to the distinction between inhuman and degrading treatment and torture, and the treatment of homosexuals and transsexuals. The second point is also misplaced. There is nothing un-British or foreign about the content of the convention rights, to which British negotiators made a great contribution, nor, in the land which gave birth to Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights 1689, is there anything antithetical to the United Kingdom Constitution in the notion of a bill or charter of rights. There are no doubt rights which could be added to those guaranteed by the European Convention and its protocols, but the Convention imposes a minimum, not a maximum. Any state which chooses to secure more extensive rights than the Convention guarantees is not precluded from doing so. The Act is also criticised, seventhly, for not doing too much, but for doing too little. For instance, Henry Porter, the Observer journalist I mentioned before, has eloquently deplored the failure of the Act to stem the seemingly inexorable increase of personal surveillance in Britain, making the British, as has been suggested, perhaps the most spied upon people in the free democratic world. I share his concern, but I question whether this result can be attributed to a defect in the convention. The courts can, after all, only rule on complaints which litigants choose to bring before them, and it seems that, on the whole, the British public is less concerned about official intrusion into their private affairs than one might expect, perhaps because they don't appreciate the extent to which it's going on. I come to an eighth criticism. This is that the effect of the convention is to elevate the rights of the individual over those of the community to which he or she belongs. I do not consider this to be a justified criticism. While some of the convention rights, such as the prohibition of torture, are expressed in unqualified terms and have on occasion been applied in an unqualified way, it has been repeatedly held in Strasbourg that, quote, inherent in the whole of the convention is a search for a fair balance between the demands of the general interests of the community and the requirements of the protection of the individual's fundamental rights, a theme loyally and repeatedly echoed in the domestic cases. To the extent that individual rights have been improperly preferred to community rights, this is a perversion and not an implementation of the convention. The ninth criticism, I've only got 10 of them, so we're near the end. The ninth criticism is that the Act and the convention provide a field day for lawyers. It was, I think, anticipated in the United Kingdom that giving domestic force to the Act might lead to an uncontrollable flood of litigation. That has not proved to be the case, nor has it in Victoria, where I've just been and where I encountered some sense of puzzlement among both the judges and practitioners at the relative lack of uptake, if one uses that expression, of the Act. I think it's true to say that the impact of the Act has been greater than I myself thought it would be, but it certainly hasn't turned the world upside down. The tenth and last criticism, which I've mentioned, is it justified, the most serious of all, that the convention gives rise to much wrong decision-making. This must be a matter of opinion. There are Strasbourg decisions, which I myself consider wrong, and domestic decisions also, which I've been party to overruling. It's not, however, uncommon that judicial decisions fail to command universal acceptance. And I don't think that the incidence of aberrant decision-making is greater in this field than in others. Challenged to identify decisions they criticise as foolish or mischievous, most critics either falter or fall back on what turn out to be not judicial decisions, but misconceived interpretations of the Act by official bodies. What is perhaps more remarkable, because more unusual, is the development of a constructive dialogue between the United Kingdom courts and that at Strasbourg, where the Strasbourg court gives a judgment which the EU courts venture to criticise. The Strasbourg court has on more than one occasion shown a refreshing willingness to modify its position. These are, I think, the main criticisms directed at the Human Rights Act and the European Convention. As will be obvious, they don't, in my opinion, amount to very much. They don't begin to outweigh the very real benefit which the Act confers by empowering the courts to uphold certain very basic safeguards, even, indeed particularly, for those members of society who are most disadvantaged, most vulnerable, and least well represented in any democratic representative assembly. Decisions have undoubtedly been made in the United Kingdom, which, in my opinion, have been beneficial and which would not, in some cases could not, have been made without the mandate given by the Act. Examples are plentiful, but among those which spring readily to my mind are the ordering of a public inquiry into the beating to death of a young Asian detainee by a rabidly racist and violent detainee. He had a swastika tattooed on his forehead, put into the same cell at a young offenders institution. A finding that the conditions in which prisoners were held at Barlinnie Prison in Glasgow amounted to inhuman and degrading treatment or punishment. A finding that the indefinite detention of foreign nationals suspected of association with terrorism without charge or trial was disproportionate, irrational, and discriminatory. A finding that an 18-hour curfew, coupled with stringent restrictions on where the subject could go, whom he could meet, and whom he might speak to, amounted to an unlawful deprivation of liberty. A finding that temporary judges in Scotland lacked the security necessary to make them appear to be independent, an independent and impartial tribunal. An order restraining the return of a mother and child to Lebanon, where under the law prevailing in that country, the child would have been required to live with a violent and abusive father alone, whom she had never actually met. A finding that the police had unlawfully interfered with a demonstration against the Iraq war outside a Royal Air Force base in Gloucestershire, and an order condemning as discriminatory and disproportionate a scheme requiring immigrants seeking to marry otherwise than under the rights of the Church of England to obtain the consent of the Secretary of State. These examples could, as I say, be multiplied. I don't, for my part, doubt that such decisions enhance the fairness, decency, and cohesiveness of the society in which we in the United Kingdom live. Thank you very much.